This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of New Books in Japanese Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I am Jenny Lee. With us in today's episode are Drs. Robert Oman from Leeds Meikan University in Japan and Dr. Yuki Ueno from University of Toulouse Jean Jouy in France. Their co-edited volume, Sexual Abuse and Education in Japan, in the International Shadows, was recently published through Routledge. This volume discusses Japan's treatment of women, the difficulties that women face when they experience sexual abuse in work and school, as well as the progress of the Me Too movement in Japan. So welcome, Robert and Yuki. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting us. Great to be here.
Thank you. Thank you. Before we jump into this very informative book, can you just tell us about yourselves? What do you research and teach about?
Yuki-san, you should go ahead
first. Okay. So I currently live in France, but I grew up in Japan and spent most of my life in Japan. And as most of Japanese women, I was familiar with any kind of sexual abuse in Japanese society. I met a mentor in college in Osaka in 2009 and started having interest in feminism and gender studies as a research domain. My recent research has been focusing on sexualization of school uniforms and female domination in Japanese society. I'm working as a lecturer in University of Toulouse Jean Jaurès in France from 2019, and I'm teaching Japanese language. I also hold lectures as a dating violence prevention program facilitator from Association Aware in Japan.
Thank you, Yuki. How about you, Robert?
Yeah, I grew up in Ireland. I guess you picked up on the accent, maybe, but I've been teaching in Japan since 1998. My doctoral dissertation in 2005 took a masculinity studies approach to focus on the situation for LGBT students and instructors in educational contexts in Japan. I joined Ritsu Meikan University's College of International Relations in 2014. I do content-based teaching for language education courses. I teach academic writing skills to global studies students here. I'm still interested in sexual identity issues for research and content-based teaching, but since publishing our book, my main research focus is on sexual abuse issues in Japan.
Thank you. We have a very internationally migrated crowd here today.
Yeah.
So what prompted you to start this volume project?
Well, for me, I heard about a Me Too event in Osaka in February 2018. I expected to see a huge crowd at the event, but in fact, the audience was small, only around 30 people. So from then on, I was trying to understand why movements like Me Too don't seem to be successful in this particular social context. And as a man, as an outsider, a non-native speaker who can't speak on behalf of women in Japan, I knew it was important to do research and interpret data in collaboration with a Japanese woman. So I was very fortunate to be able to make contact with Yuki, and she was willing to work with me on the project. So then it became possible to think about researching this volume for publication.
Yuki, would you like to add something?
Just a few things. So I was very happy when Robert accepted me as his co-author, because this was a time I actually started writing about Japanese society for the first time in an academic area, influenced by Ito Shiori, who is same age as me and is one of the most courageous women. And I was actually doing historical social research about Japan at a graduate school in France, knowing that I wanted to confront the society where I live today. But it took me many years to speak up, and I knew how difficult it would be. So after a lot of hesitation, I finally decided to change my direction. And 2 months later, I got an offer for this project.
That's amazing. And I definitely want to get back to some of the things that you mentioned. So how is this book structured?
So the initial research questions were, is sexual misconduct a widespread social problem in Japan? What sort of public conversations are people having around sexual abuse issues? How are the issues perceived within society and in educational institutions? And we focused on the views of university students, and we surveyed 800 of them in total to answer questions like, do university students in Japan have progressive views on sexual harassment? Are they aware of the harm that's caused by sexual abuse? Do they support prevention policies? Do they, in contrast, tend to blame victims rather than perpetrators? So chapters 1 and 2 explore these issues for Japanese society and educational contexts in Japan. Then when we try to answer the question of why is it so difficult for sexual assault survivors to come out of the shadows and pursue justice, we find that there are some factors which have not really been taken into account and which can be explored through a psychosocial approach. So the following chapters of the book deal with male hysteria as a subject position of the nativist right factions. We look at international status anxiety, or ISA. I'll talk about that a bit more later. And retaliation anxiety. These are key background factors that deepen our understanding of the chilling environment for survivors of sexual abuse. And the final sections consider future possibilities. If Me Too or similar movements are not a good match for the Japanese context, what other approaches might be more helpful? So that's basically how the book is organized.
I guess before I get to the questions that I've prepared, I should probably ask you to give a definition of sexual abuse, because as I recently was asked, sexual abuse means different levels for different people. And obviously, according to some, I am too woke to that I define anything as sexual abuse. So in the context of this book, how do you define sexual abuse?
I think for the person involved, they experience something as abuse. We mentioned in the book, we use the word abuse quite consciously, because it brings home the fact that even an action which is done without the intention to abuse might be experienced as abusive. So the person has not given consent for that experience. I think that might be the most basic element in the definition. And for them, they experience that as, we don't have to use the word traumatic, but certainly it's very disturbing and unwanted and unwelcome, and they feel it's inappropriate. Does that answer it?
Yeah, of course. Yuki, what do you think?
Yeah. As we explained at the beginning of the volume, actually in Japan, we use lots of words to explain sexual abuse, such as sekuhara, the word which is used to for sexual harassment. But when we use sekuhara, it's not taken seriously. But all the harassment have to be taken seriously, and all the harassment have to be taken as abusing, sexual abuse. So actually, sexual abuse includes all the kind of harassment which is based by gender bias and sexual discrimination.
Thank you for clarifying that. Yeah. Now, what's the current general situation in Japan for women who have experienced abuse, sexual abuse and harassment? Are they protected? Are they encouraged to seek justice or to share their stories?
Yeah, in the book, we provide the findings from various sources that indicate that there are high levels of abuse and harassment in a wide range of social contexts, but the reporting rates are very low. And even when abuse is reported, the survivors of assault have a tough time gaining justice. Many schools and workplaces only have very minimal programs to raise awareness, to promote safe environments, or to encourage targets of abuse to come forward. Me Too and related movements have helped to change the situation, but not in a fundamental way. The Flower Demo campaign, for example, in major cities around Japan, allows people to come together once a month in a public space and to speak about the traumatic abuse they have suffered. Just being able to tell their story to a sympathetic audience can bring some measure of healing to survivors of abuse. However, the social problem of sexual abuse won't change fundamentally through therapeutic exercises alone. And the Flower Demo campaign may not have significant impact as few people know about it. In our survey, only 4% of young women were aware of its existence, and the women who speak there usually remain anonymous. They rarely name the perpetrator of abuse, and the social impact of the campaign is fairly limited. I think that Flower Demo is representative of the dominant attitudes and conditions here. Women are given some encouragement to share their stories, but they will not be protected from a backlash if ultra-conservative groups or online misogyny trolls target them. They run a high risk of victim blaming or being labeled as a higaishaburu or fake victim. In terms of protection from sexual harassment more generally, women and girls are not adequately protected in many workplaces, in schools, on public transportation, and so on, and they are not generally encouraged to seek justice. Overarching norms of gender inequality remain fixed, and many perpetrators can continue to abuse. So the general situation is negative in many ways.
Indeed, that's a very painful truth. I remember reading about, you mentioned Itoshi Ori earlier. So for our listeners who may not be familiar with this, Itoshi Ori was probably the first female public figure to publicly go on record to accuse of her abuser, who's also a public figure, and actually won in the lawsuit. But like you said, like Yuki, the system cannot really protect her from the backlash. And I was really sad to learn that she can't even, she had to move abroad from all the online abuse. So that's not very encouraging for other victims. So what might be some of the historical reasons for such silence from these victims, survivors?
I think the value of our book would be try to explain why the backlash is so intense in Japan. I think that's one thing that we contribute, the backlash against a person like Ito Shiori, or when there are apologies for past violence by the Japanese state. So that's just a little segue, sorry to get distracted, but your question, Janie, I think is about the historical reasons for the silence, the enforced silence of survivors of abuse. So we have a psychosexual perspective, and to interpret the history, you could say, we would say that when Japan's ruling elite took over in the early years of Meiji, they had this foundational fantasy, and it was given state backing in that nation-state project. It still continues to have influence today. If you look at parliamentary debates, military pronouncements from the time right up until the end of the Asia-Pacific War, you have extremists demanding ever more extreme demonstrations of devotion to the emperor. And those extremist groups form new constellations of power after military defeat. But the traumatic wound behind that foundational fantasy has never been healed. So there's a hypersensitive kind of fear of being decoded, or the nation's masculine identity being decoded. And that's something that affects many issues, including the treatment of historical crimes from the Asia-Pacific War. So the foundational fantasies of the hard masculinity faction demand the denial of all war crimes. And that includes crimes related to the women who were forced into sexual slavery as former Juguni Anfu, or military comfort women. And I'll just mention briefly that in the book, we always put the terms in quotation marks, comfort women. It's a highly problematic, unhelpful term, but that is what we're stuck with in academia. So we have to use it with that proviso. But in any case, the fixation with depicting comfort women as fake victims has repercussions for survivors of sexual assault today. Even if victims of abuse are not aware of comfort women issues, they are aware of the danger of being labeled a higaishaburu, fake victim. And in the book, we show how the association of ideas between ex-comfort women and fake victims and contemporary women who report sexual assault is still a factor in the silencing of women who have a right to report sexual assault, but they remain in the shadows. And I think a good illustration of how this is relevant still today is something that happened in 2020. There were prominent members of the main political party, the LDP, and there was an event there on a program that was looking at Juguni Anfu military comfort women issues. And when the issue was under discussion, a member of the House of Representatives, Sugita Mio, she made the comment, "Women can lie as much as they want." Now, she did issue an apology later for saying women can lie as much as they want, but she wasn't censured by her party for the comment. They actually refused to receive a petition against her then when it came to the LDP headquarters. She is still around. She continues to exert influence as a lawmaker in the Diet. And the comment was widely reported, so it's part of public discourse. So I think it indicated there's a determination there among ultra-conservative groups to depict ex-comfort women as fake victims to cast doubt on their oral evidence, and that will affect all sexual assault survivors. I think that's something that is an important question that we're exploring in the book.
Now, in chapter two, you focus on sexual abuse in the educational context. Why is it more likely that sexual abuse or harassment happen in some educational institutions? How does it work, and how do the survivors respond to this kind of harassment?
If a school or a university has policies in place for prevention, awareness, and response, then abuse is less likely because potential perpetrators know that they probably won't get away with it. In a safe environment, everyone knows that once you report abuse, you will be taken seriously and a series of steps will be followed to resolve your case. Unfortunately, that situation is relatively rare. The two case studies we provide in Chapter 2 are representative of educational institutions where students do not feel confident that they will be supported, or where they find that they are not believed when they go to the student support office. Very often, when they report traumatic responses due to the assault, the only response from medical staff is to prescribe medication. Most educational institutions have not provided a budget for counseling or for the collection of evidence to verify reports of assault. Additionally, in many universities, the main concern is to avoid bad publicity for the institution and to avoid lawsuits from individuals involved. This mentality is lamentable because it means that perpetrators will continue to abuse. Educational institutions have to be proactive in providing resources for prevention, awareness, and response so as to create environments that are as safe as possible. This is a case in Japan as everywhere else.
Yes, I completely agree. And recently something similar happened to some of my friends, and I'm absolutely infuriated by the fact that sometimes universities would rather protect their own reputation over the, I don't know, closure for the victims. Robert, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, I just would say that in the book, I think we provide quite a few other examples where it's very clear that the university in question is only interested, or seems to be only interested, in avoiding negative publicity. And, you know, that's a very impoverished way to deal with issues of sexual abuse.
And in your case studies, have you found, or in your surveys, have you found students, I guess in this case they're students, although I imagine that there would also be faculty members who go through harassment, how do they generally respond? Do they seek for any kind of support from the university? If they do, what kind of procedure would they take? And I guess how effective would that be?
I think that if from what I've read, that the percentage who do actually pursue justice is pretty small. Certainly most universities at least now have procedures in place, but I don't think there's a very strong commitment to proactively making sure that students and faculty are completely aware of what the guidelines and norms are and who they go to. And as Yuki mentioned earlier, very often the person they go to maybe is not well-trained or well-financed and are not able to do as much as really would be necessary to actually help the sexual assault survivor. And in our book, it's mainly those negative examples, unfortunately, of people who find that they don't believe they're going to be supported. So our case studies and our interview respondents brought home that reality. Very often they believe they're not going to be supported, so they don't actually report the abuse, or if they do, they don't have a very positive experience.
That's quite unfortunate. Well, okay, moving on to the following chapters. In discussing the psychological backgrounds of sexual violence in Japan, you focus first on international status anxiety, which I thought was a very interesting part of the book. So what do you mean by this, and how does it drive sexual violence?
Okay, yeah, the concept itself is just basically taken from the work of A. Zarakal. I think I'll probably refer to her again, but just to explain it a little bit then, I would say that I don't think it's something that's driving sexual violence, but I think that it's a type of anxiety, and the international status anxiety that creates an environment for sexual violence to not be taken seriously, for perpetrators to be excused, for victims to be blamed or condemned as fake victims. So it's significant, I think, in preventing women from reporting sexual violence. So international status anxiety, ISA, is this preoccupation with status in the hierarchy of states in the global geopolitical system. And Japan was forced into that system with unequal terms. And I mentioned Zarakal. She says that this situation and the subsequent military defeats Japan experienced left it in this ambiguous space where it doesn't really identify either with East or West. There's a sense of ontological insecurity because it doesn't feel accepted or validated in either camp. So the experience of defeat at the end of the Asia-Pacific War intensified this sense, and the ISA still plays a significant role in Japan's process of identity formation. And one particular aspect that's very unhelpful is the desire to assert Japan's moral superiority. This means that all the historical crimes, all the past violence, is denied by ultra-conservative ideologues. So in the book, we try to show the influence of international status anxiety, ISA, through this survey research. The first survey, 400 university students in 2019, that seemed to reflect very progressive views on sexual abuse issues. But when I spoke about it at a conference, many of the respondents said, no, it's because of the actual context. And yes, when we thought about it, that seems to be accurate, that the environment of the survey, it was language education classrooms, English language education, English language survey, instructors from the US, the UK, from the West, they prompted this sense of anxiety and the desire to align with the discourse of Japan's progressiveness. But that is for Western consumption. We reckon that if you change the environment or context to an everyday Japanese language context, if the survey began with questions that elicit the association of ideas between women who report sexual abuse and fake victims and the denial of evidence regarding comfort women, if you elicited those associations at the beginning of the survey, then you would have significantly less progressive results. And in that context, the respondents express international status anxiety by wanting to assert moral superiority through the denial of historical crimes by the Japanese state. And this is what we found in the second survey of 400 university students. That was 2 years later. In some cases, I would say it was 20% difference. or close to 30% in some cases. So statistically, it was significant. I think that's the key research finding from the book.
I guess the next question is more for Robert. But since you examined the role of interpretations of masculinity, so what's the historical context and how historical context of this masculinity or the misinterpretations of it, and how has it affected the current Japanese society's attitude towards sexual violence?
Okay, when Japan's nation-building project got underway in the late 1800s, there was a lot of anxiety about subordination to Western nations, and this tended to justify their policies of colonial exploitation by labeling foreign cultures as effeminate or lacking in martial militant spirit. And one example of this anxiety that was there, and we have this at the beginning of one of the chapters, from an imperial court proclamation. It said, "We greatly regret that the uniform of our court has been established following the Chinese custom, and it has become exceedingly effeminate in style and character." Now, this kind of statement was a bid for acceptance as co-equals with Western powers. It was signaling to them, "We accept your gender discourse as our own." But by specifically stigmatizing court uniforms as Chinese in style, I think the proclamation was signaling to Japan's East Asian neighbors, we are the older brother now. We are at the top of the hierarchy because we are the privileged interpreters of our co-equals in the West. So with this crystallization of a downgraded identity for Japan's neighbors, it also involved a similar downgrading for women's position in society. Misogyny was intensified. Women's right to political agency was removed completely. I think a law in 1900 actually forbade women to meet and engage in political discussion or political action. So in the popular imaginary, women were more starkly segregated into good and bad. The figure of the bad girl was constructed and stigmatized to keep down any women who asserted their full humanity. And stigmatization of bad girls also helped to justify a system by which low-income girls and women were forced into a system of civilian sexual slavery. And that's probably the most extreme expression of a masculinist desire to control women, control their sexuality, and this still has relevance today. The scholar Yumiko Mikanagi, she traces the evolution of dominant styles of masculinity over time. She says right now, there's no style of masculinity that has social dominance in Japan. So she doesn't use the term hegemonic masculinity here. Right now, she would say it's a time of intense ideological struggle and backlash against previous gains. Feminists have a difficult task because the role of social media platforms has rejuvenated discourses on misogyny, homophobia, ultranationalism, and the like. This is something I experienced with my own students. It's only in the past few years, but in every class in the past few years, there's one or two male students, and it's very clear that they are in a bubble, I think, and in the what they call the manosphere. And unfortunately, it's basically ideas that we can call misogynistic or ultranationalist are coming to the fore. So I can see it in myself just interacting with students. So I think there is a keener danger now of a revival of the most toxic form of masculinity, soldier masculinity from the 1930s and war era, that explicitly subordinates women to men. It only values men who display militaristic toughness at the service of the emperor and of the nation. So on the level of the psyche, male hysterical subjectivity still seems to permeate the hard masculinity style of extremist groups in this country. the ruling elite is not going to enter into rational discussion on these issues. So other forms of activism need to be found to avoid inciting a debilitating backlash. That's, I guess, part of the reason why we say we need to find alternatives, alternative strategies, because a Me Too approach is probably going to incite such a backlash that in the long term, it's going to be counterproductive. That's our argument.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Now, Yuki, I would I'm really curious how you view this this kind of interpretation of masculinity from your perspective. Because so personally, in my own experience in Japan as a female non-Japanese academic, very junior, not even officially academic, I've definitely seen this understanding of masculinity being things like, oh, you gotta be, I guess one of them is to be able to drink a lot of alcohol. For some reason, people take that as a sign of masculinity. Or signs like be able to boss around your kohai, your female colleagues, or to give orders, to make the final decision, that kind of things. So Yuki, from your own research and maybe your own experience, how do you view this interpretation of masculinity and its relationship with sexual abuse in educational institutions?
It's complicated because actually I do research in France and I don't see any difference of masculinity created by the society in France and in Japan. So in France as well, they have this masculinity that man has to be like this and may have to be like this as Japan. But the difference between, for example, between France and Japan is that in France, the society accept less. And in Japanese society, support this masculinity. And so that I think that's a difference between between the country where we think that gender equality is more developed than Japan. So actually, we all have this image of masculinity in all countries, but in Japan, we still have this society which accept this masculinity, this creation of masculinity, and which support the develop this masculinity. So that's what I see here.
Yes, it's very interesting. I was living in Kyushu before I moved here to Tokyo, and it was certainly interesting to see the pride that some of the men take for being a Kyushu danji, the Kyushu masculinity men, I guess. My next question is also for you, Yuki.
Just one second.
Yes.
I was just going to say one other contrast, maybe. I would agree with Yuki that probably masculinism is as much a problem in Western countries like France as it is in Japan, really, in many ways. But based on what we researched and my understanding of what people like Mika Nagi are saying, is that in Japan there is a ruling elite that has inordinate ability to be able to change styles of masculinity at different points in history. And they were basically able to impose or make sure that Bankara masculinity or soldier masculinity permeated the country at certain times. And the danger always is, I think still even today, that in particular circumstances or under particular conditions, they could push most men towards a more extreme version of toxic masculinity. And that's something to be concerned about.
Yes, yes, of course. It's of course related to our history and everything. So environment creates masculinity and Japanese masculinity. So yeah, of course.
Now that you've mentioned, Yuki, you've just mentioned briefly about the Me Too movement. And I think, Robert, you also mentioned that the Me Too movement didn't receive a lot of reaction in Japan, which I did not know.
It did have some success. I'm sure you will find many women who'd say it had a very positive role in my life and helped me to deal with sexual abuse, or maybe at least find a sense of solidarity maybe with some other women. But the numbers are not very big. And one of the issues we deal with, I think, is trying to explain why does that happen? Why couldn't it have been more impactful in society?
And the Me Too movement also, I think you mentioned in the book, towards the later part, that there was the Me Too movement and there was this Kutu movement that were influential among younger women in Japan. So how have, our listeners might be more familiar with the Me Too movement. What about the Kutu movement? What is it? How have these two movements developed in Japan? And I think what I'm most interested in is, have they changed the legal system in Japan in any way?
In recent years, the laws on rape and sexual assault have improved somewhat, but they still don't reflect the fundamental principle that consent should be the key criterion for judgment. Under Japanese law, the fundamental principle is coercion, and providing that the alleged victim was unable to prevent the assault from taking place. And in fact, the focus should be on consent. This is a fundamental change that activists hope to see in the legal system and in society more broadly, so that sexual partners always seek positive expressions of consent before they engage in any sexual activity. Me Too has helped to bring that day nearer, but its role has been quite limited for reasons we explained in the volume. And the Kutu campaign had a good deal of success for one single issue, rules about footwear in the workplace. Many women have been able to speak out in their workplaces and to get rid of a policy that had them wearing uncomfortable or painful footwear while their male colleagues didn't have that problem. But I think it's worth mentioning a comment from one of our interview participants, Greg, which was, "Is that all? You know, Me Too and its spin-off movements were supposed to hold hundreds of perpetrators of abuse accountable and to turn many workplaces and public spaces into safe environment for women. That never happened. Yes, progress was made on the footwear issue, which is great, but you can understand the reaction. Is that all? And our survey of over 200 young Japanese women found that only 46% have ever heard of Me Too, and only 26% had ever heard of Kutu. So campaigns and movements need to reach a much larger demographic slice if they are to have any long-term impact.
Now, to expand this to a larger context, moving forward from the perspectives of this volume and the perspectives of your research, what are some potential or, I guess, necessary measures to be taken in order to protect women in Japan from sexual violence, or to protect them after it has happened, or even to encourage them to speak out against what they've experienced?
Robert mentioned the case of Ito Shiori earlier, and maybe some listeners have read her account of sexual violence in her book Black Box. Her experience shows what is lacking for survivors of abuse. Very few rape crisis centers, many hospitals and police facilities without kits that can collect DNA and test blood to obtain evidence of rape and other forms of sexual violence. Very few police stations with trained female police officers who can reduce the trauma level for survivors. In Japan, the term second rape has become widely used to describe the horrendous experiences of many women who are interrogated by police and legal staff who conduct the questioning and examinations in very unhelpful ways. With regard to sexual harassment in workplaces and educational institutions, policymakers need to prioritize budgets that fund programs and permanent structures for raising awareness, for preventing abuse from happening, and for a comprehensive response to all those who are brave enough to report abuse. Additionally, public representatives have to be held accountable when they initiate public conversations that promote victim blaming of women who report sexual assault or that trivialize the actions of the perpetrators. Young men receive the message, "You can't control your sexual urges, so it's up to women and girls to avoid inciting your biological urges." That is a terrible message to give boys and young men, and we need comprehensive education programs to shape healthy styles of masculinity among young men. As educators, we know it is essential to provide comprehensive education in sexuality, relationships, and consent issues for young people so that women and girls can study and work without having to deal with environments of gender harassment or other forms of sexual harassment. In Japan, if Japan adopted these measures, and if it put the lid on denials of historical crimes of sexual violence, it might just gain the respect and status it hopes for on the international stage. Certainly, the current approaches adopted by ultra-conservative forces are not achieving those goals, and they are not creating safe environments for women and girls. So it's time for social transformation, we believe, at least. And let's hope readers find our arguments convincing.
I hope so. Robert, would you like to add anything?
Yeah. I would say in recent years, anti-feminist groups have succeeded in associating the word victim with victim mentality here in Japan. Victims often think it would be better for them to be self-reliant and bear their pain alone without causing trouble for people around them. And extreme right-wing or anti-feminist groups have pushed the notion of the fake victim, Higaishaburu, that Yuki mentioned. That's been pushed into public consciousness a lot. So the number of cases where women make false reports of sexual abuse is tiny. But in spite of that, many members of the public are deeply suspicious of women who claim sexual assault, and survivors of assault often feel that the onus is on them to prove that they are not fake victims. So we need to recognize this situation and respond to it if we are, you know, going to change the environment and protect women and girls and everybody. It's worth noting also, I think, that the determination that's there to ignore historical evidence regarding the system of comfort women, military sexual slavery, also extends to the denial of the system of civilian sexual slavery, which operated legally in Japan until the end of the Asia-Pacific War. The scholar Caroline Norma shows that the conditions of work for Japanese women in the legalized brothel system were conditions of sexual slavery. So activists for comfort women in Japan, Korea, China and elsewhere could work together to encompass those narratives of those women and girls. Maybe that could help to depoliticize the nationalistic fervor associated with comfort women issues in each of these countries and replace it with a strong sense of solidarity among women. And this might help to undo the stigma associated with comfort women issues in Japan and reduce the fear of being labeled as a fake victim. So over the long term, it's just one small part of the solution. We're not saying that this will be the answer, but it could be one part of the solution to help survivors of sexual assault to come out of the shadows.
One last quick question. So throughout your research, throughout your survey and interviews, have you found any resources that you might recommend to students or even faculty members, people who are going through sexual harassment in educational institutes that they can reach out to?
Let me see, because we didn't include some in the appendix. Maybe if I saw some of them. There is an appendix that includes a few websites, information on support for victims of sexual abuse. I think mainly the best ones perhaps are the most helpful. There's one in Osaka, the Sexual Assault Crisis Healing Intervention Center. I think the main cities have equivalent types of organizations. There any of those sexual assault crisis healing centers. Unfortunately, they're only in the big cities. They should be in, you know, in smaller towns as well. We give a list of the harassment guidelines in some universities, and any university student or high school student has the right to find out and get the information so that they know what procedures are in place, who they go to for help if anything happens. And we include, there's one organization, Chabujo, Flipping the Table Over. They do a lot of activism against sexual assault. They go to universities and schools and talk about domestic violence and sexual violence. As I remember, I think the name comes from this stereotypical notion of the male patriarchal figure who just in a burst of anger flips the table over and just expresses his anger, and who knows, you know, how abusive he could be. But they're saying, well, we also have a right to flip the table over and be angry and speak out about the kind of abusive practices we have to put up with. So yeah, you might find some helpful resources in that appendix at the back of the book.
And if I can add something, we didn't include in appendix, but actually now schools don't give much education about harassment and violence, dating violence to children. at school, but they started inviting facilitators and program facilitators from outside of schools. And there is one organization which is reliable, and which called Aria. So I'm one of the member. If you go to the website, you can see the list of all the member of the facilitators who are trained in this association, and schools and societies can invite these facilitators to give educational programs to from Japan. I think it's from junior high school to universities. So if any school, if any listeners are working in schools, and if you are thinking of inviting somebody to give educational lectures, you can also look at this this association called Aware.
Thank you very much. And listeners can find the link in the description of this episode. Well, thank you, Yuki and Robert, for your time in joining us in this episode today.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to be here with you.
Thank you. And for our listeners who want to learn more about sexual abuse and feminist activism in Japan, make sure to check out this new book, Sexual Abuse and Education in Japan in the International Shadows, by Robert Omohan and Yuki Ueno. This book is currently available in hardback and ebook. This is Jinyi Lee from New Books in Japanese Studies. Stay tuned for our next episode.